What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss. As we've done just about every Monday since October of 2023, Law and Disorder returns this morning to our recurring segment, The Palestine Post, discussing the latest news from Israel's genocide in Gaza and the efforts that people are taking around the world to stop it. On today's show, we'll start with latest news from over the weekend in Gaza, and then we'll turn to other developments in the region, particularly in Syria, and how they relate to the treacherous reach of Zionism. We're joined today by Asa Winstanley, an author and investigative journalist who writes for the Electronic Intifada. His latest article there is titled, Why Israel Thinks It Won in Syria. Asa Winstanley joins us from London. Asa, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
It is a real pleasure to have you on. Unfortunately, we are talking about unpleasurable news, but let's start with latest from over the weekend in Gaza. Israeli forces bombed an UNRWA school in Khan Yunis, killing at least 20 people, including kids. And that attack followed another attack on a school in northern Beit Hanun that killed 43 people. What do we know at this point, particularly since the pause in fighting at Israel's northern border with Lebanon? What do we know about the rate at which Israel is leveling violence in Gaza right now?
Well, we know that it's genocide, despite what Western leaders are saying. I don't know. At this point, it's hard to know what more to say about Gaza. We're just seeing the worst crimes happening every day. Every day there's more children killed, there's more schools targeted, more hospitals, mosques. Everything is completely flattened, the northern Gaza Strip especially, but also targeted as well as the so-called safe areas, the areas where the Israelis said that the Palestinians should flee to. So what we're seeing in the Gaza Strip is a genocide. You know, it's a Holocaust. It's the Holocaust of our times. And this is what the Israelis are doing. They are trying to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible, especially from Gaza.
The two attacks by Israel that I mentioned earlier in Khan Yunis and Beit Hanun were both on schools. Every time I see that, it is still shocking to me. But at this point in Israel's kind of public information wars, are they being pushed in any way to justify the way that they choose their targets, which we know have included over, you know, the past year plus various types of institutions that include hospitals and schools? Earlier in the onslaught of violence, they were pushed in some way because of the shock of it all to do some justification, whether or not the justification made any sense publicly. Are they at this point, given that we've seen this kind of pattern over and over, are they trying to address that in the information war?
No, it doesn't seem so. There's no pretense anymore. Like, the schools are being targeted because, you know, teaching is not really going on anymore, except, you know, on a local sort of level. But, you know, in the course of this genocide, there's not really a normal school day happening. What's happening in the schools is that people are, because they're UN schools, right? Because they UNRWA, the UN refugee, UN agency for Palestinian refugees, because they're UNRWA schools, people are fleeing to them to shelter in them. And that's why these are being targeted, because there's lots of people there. And that is the goal of this genocide, is to kill Palestinians. Yeah, you're right. Like, they've dropped all pretense. Like, in the beginning, you know, remember when the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital was targeted? They, right. You know, it was very, very... It got a lot of attention in the media, and Israel instantly tried to justify it and said, said lies about it, that it wasn't even them. They claimed that it was a misfiring Palestinian resistance rocket. Completely untrue. All investigations that were done into that showed that it was the Israelis. But in the Western media and Western leaders, they gave such a, they prevaricated about it so much, it cast enough doubt for a time that it let the Israelis carry on with what they were doing, and by now they don't even bother justifying it anymore. How many hospitals have they attacked since then? I've lost
You know,
count.
it reminds me of the first time I saw news of Israel attacking people who were waiting in line to receive aid. I think they were waiting in line to receive flour, to potentially make some food with, and it was shocking. And since then, it's to me, it's been just as shocking to see that news happen over and over, that people are waiting in line to receive what small amounts of aid they might be able to and are attacked. I want to move to a little conversation about journalism there. At this point, 195 journalists have been killed in Gaza since the beginning of Israel's onslaught. A different Israeli airstrike than the two that I mentioned on schools earlier, over the weekend, killed Palestinian journalist Ahmed Alou, who was a journalist with Al Jazeera, and he was the third journalist killed in Gaza within a 24-hour period. You work with the Electronic Intifada, a big part, in addition to the analysis that you all present. You all are also providing news about what's happening in the region. And so I'm wondering at this point, from your perspective on trying to get news out, what does it take for a journalist to operate in the Gaza Strip? And then how are you all at Electronic Intifada getting information from the ground, but while intending and trying to support the safety of your contacts?
Yeah, I don't know how they do it, to be quite frank with you. It's amazing how this journalists are still going in Gaza, that we're relying on them for everything. They're still managing to get news out. Like our colleagues in Gaza are heroes, really, and they're paying in many cases the ultimate price for it. They are, just simple things like that we take for granted, equipment, basic journalist equipment like laptops and mobile phones. Mobile phones now in Gaza are, if you lose or your mobile phone is destroyed, it's pretty much impossible to replace. They're going for, even the most simple mobile phones are going for hundreds and hundreds of dollars because they're in such short supply. Their journalists are just writing, in some cases, just on their phones. It's unimaginable what they're going, the things that they're going through, and yet they still manage to do it. They still manage to find a way to keep on doing their jobs and to keep on reporting the genocide that's happening. And even despite the fact that everything that we're all doing, that our colleagues in Gaza are doing, and that we outside are trying to do to bring their stories to people in the West, nothing is working. Nothing seems to be stopping this genocide. And this is because the Western leaders, the American president and the British Prime Minister, and so on and so forth, have given Israel complete carte blanche, that they have complete impunity. And it's it I mean, I'm dispirited from that, and so I can't even imagine how dispirited they must be while they're even under this genocide. There's that viral video that from a few months ago of a woman in Gaza basically shouting at someone who was filming and saying, "What, who are you filming for? Who are you, like, why are you filming? Who's this gonna go to?" Like the reason being that the whole world has seen this, seen what's happening, and yet it's not stopping. It's still carrying on, and so it can feel hopeless sometimes. But Palestinian journalists still doing their job after 15 months of genocide is really an act of pure heroism. It's an act of resistance, really, is what it is. It's an act of defiance to Israel and what it's doing, and you can't stop the Palestinians.
Well, and Palestinian journalists have certainly been targeted, but it's not only Palestinian journalists, it's also people who are writing as journalists about Palestine, and certainly not only in Palestine. I know that you yourself, I believe in your home or perhaps in your office, were raided, and I'm wondering if you can briefly explain what happened with that and how they justified how you were targeted.
On the 17th of October, my home and my home office, so it's both, were raided by the British police, by the so-called counter-terror police, and they targeted me specifically for my journalism. They targeted me as a journalist who, as you said, focuses on Palestine. And I wasn't actually charged or even arrested with any crime. I wasn't charged with any crime or even arrested. And it was a very disturbing incident for, around a dozen police to come into my home and search my home at the crack of dawn, and they took away all my devices that I use for my journalism, my computers, my phone, and so forth. And they took it all, and they even said to me in writing that they gave me the warrant to search the premises, and a letter accompanying it, and the letter said that we are aware of your profession. So, they know that I'm a journalist. They know that what I write about, and yet they're still, I mean, that is the reason that they're targeting me. So this is it. On the heading of that letter, it said, Operation Incessantness. We don't understand yet what Operation Incessantness is. It seems to be a wider operation, not just targeting me. So there's been other journalists, activists as well, who have been targeted by this, and who, for the most part, yet haven't been charged with anything, but have been raided and their devices seized. And it just seems like a targeted harassment campaign, targeting people with proximity to the Palestinian cause, and it's happened to Richard Medhurst, a journalist. He's a member of the journalist union like me. He's a streamer. He does a lot of geopolitical analysis, and he talks about Palestine a lot. He was detained when he was crossing the border coming into Britain. Had his devices seized. The activist and journalist Sarah Wilkinson as well was also had her home raided, a far more brutal raid than me, and she was actually arrested, and I don't think has been charged with anything yet still. In December last year, the author Tony Greenstein, who is he's a prolific blogger. He's an activist. He's quite a prominent anti-Zionist Jewish activist and writer. He's written a very good book called Zionism During the Holocaust, which is about the collusion of the German Zionist movement and Zionist movements across Europe, with Nazi Germany in the 30s and the 40s, in the 1930s and 1940s.
Right.
And he was he had his devices seized, and in December last year, so a year ago, and he was actually arrested, and he did have bail conditions where they said, that he couldn't even post on Twitter. He wasn't allowed to post on Twitter. That was overturned by his lawyer, but he's now facing charges. So this week, actually, he will have to report to the police station, where he'll be charged with allegedly supporting a proscribed terrorist group. So that's the rubric that is being used. That this is the a you know this is really what it is an abuse of counter-terrorism laws in order to suppress free speech on Palestine.
And that's the voice of Asa Winstanley, a journalist with the Electronic Intifada. Asa, I hope that we will stay in touch to continue the conversation as your case develops around the raid on your home. I want to transition our conversation to Syria. I lost track of time a little bit talking about Gaza. I want to make sure we have a little bit of time to talk about Syria, where last week on December 8th, the long-standing president Bashar al-Assad was overthrown by rebels. The country faces an immense transition after that overthrow, which the forces behind it had been in the works for a very long time. The transition is complicated. There are all kinds of internal and also foreign interests that include not only questions of governance, but we've already seen land invasions in the border regions and beyond from neighboring countries, namely and on the largest scale from Israel. It's worthwhile to mention that Syria plays an important strategic, political, and geographic role in the region, where its borders include Turkey, Lebanon, Iran, and Israel. And of course, the overthrown president, Bashar al-Assad, was aligned with Iran and Russia. So, your article from last week on the Electronic Intifada was titled "Why Israel Thinks It Won in Syria." Before I literally ask you that question, which I will do, why does Israel think it won in Syria? I just want to talk about the latest developments in the country. About a week after the overthrow of the Assad regime, where does the balance of power stand in Damascus, and how safe or fragile is it?
Yeah, thanks. I think it's important to acknowledge the fact that the Syrian government was just overthrown after a 13-year proxy war led by the CIA. That is the reality that we should start with. Some people might not like to face up to that reality, and may sort of try to convince themselves that this was just, a sort of spontaneous revolution of the Syrian people. But what we've actually seen is the United States, not only the CIA, but also the Pentagon, have poured literally billions of dollars into a long proxy war against the government of Syria. In order to overthrow the government, because the government was supported primarily because the government, Syrian government, for many, many years was supportive of Palestinian resistance against Israel, armed resistance. And that's a reality. And that's the basic reality of why Israel thinks it has just won a victory in Syria, and why the one of the primary reasons that the CIA and other agencies of American imperialism have put in such efforts into overthrowing the Syrian government is because it's to support Israel. Simple as that, really. And Israel has used the downfall of the Syrian government, and really what we're looking at is the what seems it seems to me what we're looking at is most likely to happen now is the complete dismantling of the Syrian state. Like, that's what we're seeing unfold before our eyes now. Israel has taken advantage of that to invade Syria to invade new areas of Syria. It already occupied a large tract of Syria called the Golan Heights since 1967. It is now expanding that illegal occupation, and it has bombed hundreds of targets all over Syria, and it has completely essentially dismantled and disarmed the Syrian state. Like, the Syrian air defenses were actually very good, but they've now been completely destroyed. Syrian Air Force, Syrian all kinds of defense equipment has now been destroyed by Israel. So,
Well, and
it's very dark times, really.
certainly, there's one point that I want to follow up and perhaps push back a little bit on. Certainly, there are all kinds of foreign interests and coming from the West in the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad. Is it not true that that revolt also was a space of intention and need by many Syrian people who suffered under the Assad regime? This was not only a revolt that was fueled by outside.
I think
I mean, we've
that
seen images, huge images of joy and jubilation. We've seen prisons be opened from political prisoners who were being tortured and slaughtered.
I think that the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad was unpopular from a lot of people in Syria. There's no doubt about that, and there's no doubt that there was political prisoners in the Syrian prisons who have now been released. But what has happened in Syria now is, prospectively, what we're seeing is the dismantling of the state. We're seeing even the prisons, the prisons have been emptied. So that's going to mean that there's a lot of Al-Qaeda operatives who have now been released into the country, because that is all these the rebels, the so-called rebels who have now who have the so-called rebels who overthrew the Syrian government were Al-Qaeda. That's essentially what they were. They were rebranded Al-Qaeda. This Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, its leader, was the founder of Al-Qaeda in Syria, of Jabhat al-Nusra, as it was called at the time. He was an emissary from Iraq. He was sent by the leader of the Islamic State in Iraq to Syria, so as to join the war against the CIA-backed war against the Syrian government. And now, of course, they're trying to rebrand themselves and distance themselves from that past. But this is the reality of the political forces that we're facing. And in a lot of ways, it's very similar to what the United States did in Latin America in the 1980s with the Contra War against the Nicaraguan government. They backed all kinds of armed groups which were carrying out human rights abuses. And by the way, Jawlani also has prisons with political prisoners in, but they have not been released in Idlib, because he ruled over the enclave of Idlib in the northern Syria, whose so-called Salvation Government prime minister is now being put in place as a transitional prime minister. There's been protests against the his Jawlani's human rights abuses in Idlib, and so, it's not the picture that the mainstream media makes it out to be.
All right, Asa Wynn-Stanley, we're going to have to wrap it up here. I do have my next guest waiting on the line. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
That was the voice of Asa Winstanley, an investigative journalist who writes for the Electronic Intifada and also an author whose latest book is called Weaponizing Antisemitism: How the Israel Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn. You can follow his work at the Electronic Intifada. You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media. That's at lawanddis, D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law & Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.